Yo, what's up, homies? Before we get this episode underway, I just want to mention that this conversation does get quite heavy. We do cover some fairly deep topics and go into graphic detail on certain events, traumatic events that cause PTSD, anxiety, depression, suicidal thoughts with the guest, Paul Minter, who is the founder of Head Up Charity over in the UK. So if you're not in a good mindset to be able to listen to this episode, I wouldn't recommend listening to it right now. Maybe come back to it at another stage. The second point that I want to mention is that unfortunately we had some technical issues and the audio that you will hear in this conversation has been re-recorded on my part. Paul's answers, Paul's conversation, Paul's side of the conversation is authentic. However, I had to re-record some of my or all of my audio because of technical issues. So I've tried to keep the conversation as authentic and as real as possible. Yo, what's up, guys? Welcome to this episode of the Live, Train, Perform podcast. I'm your host, Sean Coba, and joining me today, I have Paul Minter, who is the founder of Head Up Charity over in the UK. Now, I've got him on to tie in with what the lads from Swiss 8 are doing in Australia in regards to the mental health space. Paul's doing something very similar over in the UK, so I've got him on to have a chat about what's going on there, his background, and why he started the charity. Paul, welcome to the episode, mate.
Oh, thanks a lot. Yeah, I've been waiting for this for quite a while now, so excited to get talking.
Yeah, sweet, mate. I'm really looking forward to this conversation. Now, for those who have been following the podcast, this connection between Paul and myself was made through Simon Maloney, who was the sniper that was shot in the throat in Afghanistan and was subsequently awarded the Conspicuous Gallantry Cross by Her Majesty the Queen. So, mate, let's discuss your military background, your military career. You know, everything that led up to you joining the army, what you did in the army, and just kind of give myself and my listeners a brief 5-minute introduction to yourself.
Yeah, sure. So a brief introduction. I'll just give you an outline of who I was, what I've done, kind of where I am now. So I was born in London, the east end of London in England. Quite a rough area when I was younger. I had parents who were kind of like opposite. So my dad come from a very rough, tough background and very disciplined way of upbringing. He was out drinking, fighting, gambling most of the time, which I kind of looked up to because it's kind of like what happened in my local area anyway. And my mum was brought up from a very posh side of family, very wealthy. But because she was mixed race, so she was kind of outed by a lot of the family, and somehow my mum and dad came together, brought me up. I had two elder sisters. I was into my fitness a lot, so I'd done lots of football, lots of running, basketball, rugby, boxing was one of my big things. It's a family sport, so I was into boxing a lot. But I was a little bit of a runaway kid. I was running around, stealing cars, setting fires to bins, silly stuff like that, you know, as you do as you grow older. Silly stuff looking back on it now, it's ridiculous, but it's just the kind of lifestyle I was living when I was younger. Anyway, as I got a bit older, the kind of people I used to hang around with, the severity started to get a lot worse. You know, they started getting, you know, by the age of 13, they were quite heavily into drug dealing, some of them taking quite heavy drugs, quite a lot of them were going to juvenile prison. The crimes that they were doing were going up, including like, you know, stuff like throwing acid at people and all sorts of stuff like that. And, you know, my morals, like even as bad as my dad sometimes was, he also had morals. They brought me up knowing you can't be doing stuff like that. You don't hurt other people even if you're going to do something wrong. So I kind of like distanced myself from that. And the way to distance it, as soon as I turned like 15 or left school, I just joined the army. I thought, you know what, army is something I want to join. I don't want to hang around with these boys who, like, three or four of them are in prison, two of them being killed over drugs. And I thought, like, get out of this. You know, I'm not that stupid. And so I joined the army, and I absolutely loved it. It wasn't as tough as I thought it was going to be. I was expecting it to be extremely tough. I loved running, you know, crawling around in the mud. I loved firing a weapon. I loved running around. I loved anything that, you know, if you could put 30, 40, 50 kilograms on my back, I would just love to run the furthest. If I wasn't running the further with it, than anyone else, I'll be absolutely disappointed in myself when I come in later on. So that's the kind of soldier I was growing up. At a quite young age, so I think age of 20, we were the first ones called up into Afghanistan, 2006 into Helmand Province. So we were the first ones, it's the Russians, to go into Helmand Province. So every area we went to was brand new. And there were some hardcore fighters out there. And I think I was a gunner. And I think literally every single day we were just fighting, protecting people. There was lots of people that the Taliban were like killing the local like people like every day. You could just see that bodies laying around everywhere. And the villagers openly welcomed us and helped us to try and fight the Taliban off. So yeah, every day we were doing that. And you know, I racked up dozens and dozens of kills, you know, confirmed kills at that time. I also was involved in an ambush where my vehicle got blown up with rocket propelled grenades. The first vehicle ever to be hit by rocket propelled grenades and not be impersonated and then blown up inside. So I saw the rocket propelled grenade coming. And I was thinking, oh, well, this is it. This is the end of my life. But we got these new, like, bar armors that go on the side of vehicles and it got stuck in the middle of it and it, you know, it just blew up the side of the vehicle rather than coming inside the vehicle and then blowing us up. And then I think, unfortunately, the vehicle behind got blown up. Everyone inside of it died. You can see like the bodies burning and everything. It was pretty, very traumatic. But this is my first trip. Yeah, I mean, we're a couple months in of like non-stop fighting, so it wasn't the fighting side of it wasn't a shock. But you know, just like whoa, you know. And we lost comms. Well, the outside lost comms to us. We could hear everyone else, and they said we need to withdraw. Everyone's dead, but we weren't dead. We were still alive, but they thought we were. So they bugged out and got to top to high ground to fight the Taliban. It was like over 100 of them trying to get into our vehicles. And I'm standing on top of them, throwing grenades, shooting them like, as they were coming towards me. But we can delve into that a bit later on. But I mean, that was the first real traumatic thing that happened to me, but not realizing it at the time.
And you were 20 years old at the time, right?
20 years old at the time, yeah.
And that was first deployment to Afghanistan. How many deployments did you end up doing?
So five in total. So yes, yeah, so I've done that one. I bounced straight onto another one, but this one was in Iraq, and we were doing covert surveillance. So I joined a specific unit called Brigade Reconnaissance Force, which is something I would have spoken about on previous podcast. We were just literally doing covert surveillance. So in bushes, in rooftops, just hiding out for weeks at a time, just gathering intelligence and passing it on to special forces. It was a fantastic thing. So it was like going from one extreme of completely kinetic to completely covert surveillance stuff. And yeah, it was just fantastic. And then I done another one on top of that, another one on top of that, another one on top of that. And I loved each time I went out, it was good. But I did notice towards the end of the last two, you know, like it was no longer... A lot of people would say, oh, yeah, you're so brave or you're so experienced. But yeah, I think it was just a case of I didn't care anymore, you know. I was just like, it's just, you know, I think when you get to a stage of not caring, you can get quite dangerous. But yeah, so I done those tours. And then towards the end of my career, I started feeling a lot of feelings I've never felt before. Like by the age of 27, I never really heard of the word depression or mental health. It just wasn't spoke about in my circles or anywhere that I went. So I've heard the words, but I never even knew roughly what they meant. So when I started getting like serious paranoia, like my brain was starting to go funny and I didn't understand what was going on. And it caused me to end up fighting a lot because I thought people were like talking about me, taking a mick out of me, all sorts of stuff. And then I started getting depressed, I started getting anxious, but at the same time, as I'm having all these problems, I'm still like aiming to be the best I can. So I'm going on all these like high pressure courses, I'm doing all this high pressure stuff and putting myself into like extra curriculum stuff whilst suffering all this stuff, not realizing what it is, just brushing it off the side. And and in the end, I broke and it just got the worst of me. And I didn't know how to handle it, didn't know what to do with it. Didn't feel like there was anyone I could speak to because I didn't know what to say or what am I supposed to say to someone about a feeling that I didn't understand or if they'd even believe me. So the long and short of it is, I ended up getting help from the military, which, to be honest, wasn't the best. It was quite substandard. For what I needed anyway. It's kind of like they put everyone into a box, no matter what your conditions were. Like, there was me who was very suicidal, like literally not even like, trying my best to say I'm not suicidal, but very blatantly asking for help because I was. And putting me on the same courses as, you know, a young a young lad who had fallen, you know, fallen over and hurt his knee and was off course for 8 weeks. And, you know, and they're trying to teach us the same thing in the same bracket, and it just didn't make any sense.
Mate, thank you so much for sharing, man. What an incredible start to today's episode. Now, this is one of the reasons that I wanted to get you on, was to talk about what you've dealt with in regards to PTSD, anxiety and depression. You are the founder of Head Up Charity over in the UK, which is working in the mental health space. I'm actually an ambassador for Swiss 8, which is a proactive mental health program designed to allow people to structure in the 8 pillars of health and wellness via an app on your phone, so you can schedule in their 8 pillars into your calendar. And their 8 pillars are sleep, nutrition, discipline, time management, fitness, personal growth, mindfulness, and minimalism. Do any of those pillars stand out to you?
Yeah, I mean, a lot of them all stand out. I think they're all very much interconnected, and you need to be working on all of them to really, really progress in life. I mean, you can do one or two of them, and you'll be on a good path. But when you start implementing them all, you'll be brilliant. But it takes a long time to do that. It takes a lot of time and effort, and I think people have got to allow themselves time to work on each one, or little snippets of each one at a time, rather than delving in too deep. But I would say overall, I think personal development. I mean, I know how important sleep is, and the sort of troubles that you could have from sleep. But from my own self experience, is I could sleep. I mean, I spent about three, four months, literally in bed, not moving. And I got as much sleep as I wanted to, but I still didn't get anywhere. I still wasn't good. I wasn't tired. That's all it was. But personal development, if you want to progress in life, if you want to go forward and you want to start achieving stuff, and you want to start to become prosperous in life, you need to you need personal development. You need to stimulate yourself. You need something to feel self-worth about. So I'll definitely say personal development.
I love that answer, man. I actually had a very similar conversation to this with someone recently. And something you mentioned there was achievement. And achievement for me is, it's almost like the meaning of life, right? If I'm achieving things every day, I'm winning every hour, which adds into days, which adds into weeks, which adds into months, which adds into years. Like if I'm winning the day more often than I'm not winning the day, then that is achievement for me. That means that I'm moving in the right direction. That's those one percenters that add up over long periods of time. And if we become complacent and we're losing the day more often than we're winning it, then we start moving in the wrong direction. So, it's easy to maintain momentum once you've already built that momentum. It's very difficult to build that momentum. Now, to build momentum, we can build momentum in a positive manner, meaning that we're doing the right things more often than not and we're winning the day. And we can also build momentum in a negative manner, where we're losing the day more often than not and we're doing things that sabotage us moving in the right direction. So, you know, a big thing here is awareness, understanding whether you're walking up the hill or down the hill, or whether you're staying level, and using different tools to have a look at where you're at, and then simply tweaking and adjusting the tools that you're using to make sure that you're kind of course correcting as you go. Now, you say that personal growth, personal development is a massive one for you at the moment. Have you had those priorities in a different order through different stages of your life?
Yeah, I mean, certainly. I mean, it depends where you are mentally as well, doesn't it? You know, if you're in such a bad place that you're struggling to get out of bed, then discipline is probably going to be one of the most important ones for you. Get the discipline to get some clothes on, discipline to have a shower, discipline to get outside the door. You know, that it takes a lot of effort to do when you're in such a bad place. If you're mentally in a good place, and you know, personal development, and if you're already developing quite well in life, then maybe you need to start looking at your sleep. Are you getting enough sleep to improve that? You know, so I'll definitely say at different points in my life, it depends where I am mentally, and I think you know it can change weekly, daily. And you've got to just keep assessing where am I, where are my strengths, where are my weaknesses. Look at these eight pillars, you know, have them on, have them somewhere physically you can look at constantly, and then maybe have some sort of a percentage next to it and say, all right, how am I doing today with this, or this week or this month? Am I at 20%, 40%, 60%? And then start working on the weaker pillar. I think that's quite a good thing to do.
That's a great point, man. All of these things that we're talking about are tools, so we need to choose the right tool for the right time. Now, as an example, if I have a poor night's sleep, then I can't necessarily prioritize sleep throughout the day. I've still got to get shit done. So what I am going to do is focus on my nutrition and my training, and I'm not hammering myself. I'm doing something that's going to improve my energy levels rather than take away from them. And I'm also going to be looking at allocating time and tasks to my energy levels. So as an example, I had a friend's birthday party on the weekend and, you know, drank too much and had a late night and ate pretty shitty the following day. So yesterday being Monday, my energy levels were a little bit low. So I made sure that what I was doing throughout the day was being adjusted to suit those energy levels. Now, when I get up in the morning, I make sure that I write out the list of things that I want, need to get done for the day, and then the things that I want to get done for the day. And those tasks that are of high priority, if my energy levels aren't matching what's required to be able to get those tasks done, then I simply push those things down the list and I do something that is going to match my energy levels, but I'm still creating a win for the day. I'm still creating these small achievements to allow me to continue moving in the right direction. And as you said, mate, these things are all tools. So it's up to us to look at these tools and use the right tool at the right time to elicit the result that we want. Now, what I just spoke about then was training. Now, as I said, I'm not hammering myself with training. I'm adjusting my training session so that I can walk out of the gym feeling better than when I walked in. And this is where, as you said, the discipline comes into play. You need to be disciplined in understanding that, yeah, you haven't slept as well as you could have. Your energy levels are low. You're a little bit fatigued. But not going to the gym and not doing some form of movement that's going to make you feel better is going to potentially lead to not going to the gym the next day and the next day, and we create this snowball effect. So then once I adjust my day to match my energy levels, then I know that I need to invest in my sleep for that night. That means that I'm going to be dimming my lights at a certain time. I might be wearing my blue light blocking glasses once the sun goes down. I'm minimizing screen time. I'm making my room cold and dark and having a hot shower before I go to bed. I'm doing some meditation work. I'm writing out my schedule to set myself up for the next day, which then gives me that peace of mind to get a good night's sleep so that I can get up tomorrow feeling good and being on the front foot to get after and win the day.
Just like what you just said there, and you're going throughout your day, you literally, your priority changed so many times throughout the day, didn't it? You know, you went from discipline to go and do some fizz when you really didn't want to go and do it, and then you changed to a bit of personal development to go do some work that you needed to do, and then you changed to sleep because you know that that's now the new priority. So, yeah,
bro, that's it. It's about looking at those principles and saying, all right, which one of those principles can I work on? How can I manipulate these tools so that, you know, I'm not throwing everything out the window? It's not this all or nothing mindset. I can still work on moving myself in the right direction, but I need to adjust my intensity. I need to just adjust how much time, energy, effort I'm putting into certain things. Excellent point, mate. I want to talk about some of the tools that you've used to essentially get yourself out of bed, get yourself moving again, get yourself back into a good headspace and being a contributing member of society. But before we do that, I want you to talk to me about your charity, Head Up Charity, what that's about, how that came about, and what the vision is for you moving forward.
Yeah, so Head Up Charity, which is now known as... So when I was talking to you at the beginning of this podcast, I said about the military sent me to get some further help on mental health, try and see some psychiatrists and do whatever I need to do. And initially I thought, okay, I'm not really feeling it, but because it's new to me, let's just give it a go and see how we get on. So I spent several months with them doing stuff, and it turned in the end. I started to get a bit better, but I realized I was getting better when I wasn't seeing them. I was getting better throughout the weeks when I was like kind of working on myself, and then every time I went to go and see someone, I got worse, and then I was worse for a couple of days, and then it was just a continuous spiral like that. And then I worked out the reason why I was getting worse is because whatever subconsciously was going on in my head, whatever wires were crossed and were causing triggers and were causing me to feel anxious and depressed and on edge and feeling like, you know, that I was back on the front line again, was happening every time I went to see someone. And what it was is I was going into a military doctor's office. Everyone's wearing uniform. There's posters of like you would see back at the regiments or back at the unit. It had a complete military feel to it. And I was like, how am I supposed to get any help whilst I'm in a place which caused this traumatic event to happen anyway? So the way I now explain it, and the way I looked at it, I was like, if I were the burns victim, I wouldn't be getting help next to an open fire. Or if I was in a road traffic accident, I wouldn't be seeing a counsellor on the side of a motorway, because it would just defeat the object. So why is it in the military that there's nowhere else to go in the military if you're suffering with PTSD or any sort of military mental health condition? You can't go anywhere unless it's a military involved environment. And the same with a lot of the charities. There's very few charities that offer outside the military environment, or military charity that offer help outside the military environment. So that's one of the big things I thought about when I think about a charity. I know. I thought, well, I said to the army, can you help me? Can you send me away somewhere? And they said, no, we can't fund that. And I was like, oh, great. So I'm never going to get better. And at this point, I'm still on the edge. I'm still like, you know, I've got mates around me dying quite a lot, you know, on a weekly basis. Suicide, yeah. So I was on the corridor at the time, and I was going to get help myself. And a friend who lives two doors up, I woke up one morning, and he was hanging outside my room. And I was like, you know, this is the severity of how bad things are getting. And it didn't seem like anyone, there was proper help out there. And I was just like, what is happening? Why, you know, there's lots of individuals that want to help, but as a whole, as an organization, it wasn't working. And I think as an individual, I highlighted a big reason why. But, you know, no one else wanted to seem to acknowledge that. So anyway, I said to the army, can you move me away from the barracks, because I can't get help whilst living in barracks? And they said no. So I was like, well, so you're not going to help me with an outside help away from where my triggers are, and you're not going to move me away. So Simon Maloney, who you had on before, I was speaking, a good friend of mine, and I was speaking to him, and he said, mate, move away, come and move near me, you know, get away from the environment. And I was like, yeah, okay, I will. So, you know, I spent, you know, over half my wages, monthly wages, to pay for rent nearest side lives. And then I just started working on myself, started YouTubing, YouTube channels, Google, looking for positive mindset training, seeing what I could do. And then things like journaling and affirmations started to come up, and I started implementing them, and it started work like really well. And I started looking into gut health, and I started looking at what am I putting in my body that can help me get rid of all these sugars and get rid of processed food and start getting more vitamins and minerals in me that my body needs. And it had a big effect with the brain. Then I started looking at fitness and, you know, not constantly thrashing myself all the time. That just take things nice and easy, you know, even if it means like jogging and walking, just doing that, just to get, you know, stimulate the hormones, but not overstimulating them, that you're then on edge all day. And there's just so many different things I started doing. Very quickly, I started to feel a lot better. And I had so many friends all over the place that were struggling. And so they started to come to me saying, you're doing so much better. What happened? So I then started helping them individually, saying, look, why don't you try this? And they were like, wow, this generally is working. I was like, yeah. And I thought, by this point, the military said they're going to medically discharge me. After 18 years service, they said, unfortunately, we don't think you're mentally stable to stay in the military, so we're going to discharge you, which is a big blow for me, because I never wanted to leave.
Right, so you did 18 years,
yeah,
and then you got out what year?
It was actually last November 2020. So I left then, But so just before that, I got offered a job, for example, in Africa, doing anti-poaching, like £500 a day. So I had a few other jobs lined up as well. But there was just this niggling little thing that was like, these jobs are not, it's not a purpose. It's not what I want to be doing. You know, I'm just going back to the same old treadmill again. I was like, I want to help people, but I just didn't know how. And then I was in Scotland with Sire during the lockdown, and I ran around this lock. It was like, I don't know, it was 34 miles, something like that. And as I ran around it, I had one of those epiphany moments. It's like everything just like lined out in front of me. Like, you need to start a charity. To start a charity, you know, you don't know anything about it. You're going to have to do something big to get attention, big to get backing, big to get funding. Because this is, you know, you need, I knew I wanted to create a retreat where people can go to. So going off my own experiences, away from the military environment, away from all the triggers where there isn't really any other help like that. Also, I knew I wanted a retreat where people can come to and learn all these positive mindset training. So it doesn't take away from medication. It doesn't take away from people talking to psychiatrists or anything. It just gives them another means and another tool in a bag to learn. So I come up with the idea of running 5,800 miles around the UK to bring attention to the charity. And I was supposed to leave the day after my discharge. My discharge was on the 27th of November 2020, and then the 28th. So for me personally, it was almost like I wasn't leaving. I was going straight into doing something. But because of lockdown, I wasn't able to do it. So thankfully, that was a blessing in disguise. And now I've been able to concentrate on the charities, and now we're really starting to get the charity underway. We've got so many things lined up. The charity won't be formed for another couple of months, not fully, but we're already starting to work on it, starting to get attention, starting to give talks. And that the vision is it by 2023, we've got 2 year fundraising period to raise around £3 million, which, you know, I feel fairly confident we will. And then we're going to build a luxury retreat where 10 veterans, serving soldiers from the Army, Navy, RAF, reserves, that they can get in touch with us. They don't have to have any sort of medical assessment beforehand. They just say, and they don't have to have a certain level of severity, which a lot of charities and the military say, you know, unfortunately, we can't supply this money on you because you're not as bad as the people we need to supply money on, which is very reactive, which kind of needs to be. We want to say to these people, just tell us that you're not feeling good. Book yourself onto a 7-day course. Come onto the course. We'll teach you nutrition, fitness, animal therapy, cold water therapy, red light therapy, meditations, affirmations, journaling, all these different basic tools throughout these 7 days. You can either take on board or not take on board. Some will work for you, some won't work for you. But now you've got a plethora of different platforms that you're now aware of and that you now know about. And not only that, we've kind of held your hand through the steps and leading you up and putting you back into control of your life. And say, sending you on your way. So hopefully this person won't ever need to go to a charity where he's severe enough to need that help. So that's our mission at the moment. So we've got a couple of years, we're almost formed, and then we've got a 2 year fundraising period where we want to get as many fundraisers as possible. We're going to get as much backing as we can. We're going to search for as many grants as we possibly can, and get this £3 million underway. We're going to go try and get as big as we can on social media. And then, like I say, the 5,800 mile run, I'm still doing. I'm doing it on the 1st of March, 2021. And I'm running 30 miles every single day. So, well, not every single day, but 200 days periods. I've got a few days off in between here and there. And the idea is just to meet as many people along the way as possible. I call it a run, but I'll be jogging and walking. So I want people to join me, after fundraising me. I want people to, we're trying to get as many schools and universities as possible. So as much as this is a military charity, the run itself, we want everyone to get involved, everyone to start talking about mental health, everyone to start going, you know what, we don't have to, it's not all doom and gloom. There's loads of good things out there. Just start spreading the word in a positive way.
That's a very cool concept, man. And it reminds me of what Swiss 8 was trying to do when they first started their organization. Now, something you spoke about there was all of these different tools to be able to apply to your life to start putting those pieces of the jigsaw puzzle back together. Now, one thing I want to talk about here is the autonomic nervous system. And I've spoken about this numerous times. The autonomic nervous system is the balance between the sympathetic nervous system, which is our fight or flight state, essentially our acute stress response, and the parasympathetic nervous system, which is our rest and digest, which is essential for long-term survival. Now, as a soldier, coming from a war-torn environment where you're fighting and coming back to your home location, there's not really a decompression period. And man, like our fucking cook on our patrol base was murdered like by one of the Afghani National Army soldiers that we were actually in Afghanistan to train like 2 weeks before we came home to Australia. And, you know, I went from that environment, zero decompression period. And within 2 weeks, I was, you know, with my girlfriend, with my friends, playing rugby back in that normal civilian space. And I hadn't been taught these tools to be able to, you know, deal with the emotions and all of the shit that I hadn't really had a chance to deal with in Afghanistan. And all of a sudden, I find myself back on the street, you know, where people are still in kind of their bubble. And I mean, we're in a bubble in Afghanistan as well. And what was important to us was, you know, the people either side of us and the guys that were on the ground in your team that were working towards the same thing. And in my mind, this is where a lot of issues come up is, you know, these guys come back from being in a highly sympathetic state where their stress response is upregulated, and then they're back in a safe environment and you are constantly on the lookout for potential threats. And sometimes, you know, if you're in that heightened state, then you start creating threats where there are none. And dude, like, so many things are still drilled into my brain, man. Like, if I sit down at a restaurant, I'm sitting with my back against the wall where I can see the entry and exit points. If I'm riding with friends somewhere, then I'm maintaining my spacing as I go through, you know, traffic. I'm constantly on the lookout for high ground or anywhere where there's some potential camouflage and concealment. And, you know, all of these things that were just drilled into me that became a part of my job, you know, it's very difficult to shake those things. And when you're taught to do these things, you're constantly trying to implement them. And it's very difficult to have that transition and try and switch that stuff off. And I think this is a big problem with why a lot of guys do actually fall into states of anxiety and depression and PTSD and things like that, because they haven't been taught these tools to be able to switch off the sympathetic state and drive the parasympathetic state and tell themselves that they are in a safe place and they can chill out and relax and, you know, not be on high alert all the time and turn those speakers down, so to speak. And something that worked for me when I was in Afghanistan was literally counting my breaths every night when I went to sleep. Because there was a period of a couple of weeks where I was in that highly sympathetic state. My team leader had been shot, put him on a helicopter, didn't know if he's going to live or die. Next day was back out on patrol and burst of machine gun fire went right between my mate and I. And, you know, I had to focus on my breath to allow me to get to sleep at night. Now, I wasn't taught how to do that. I just had to figure out a way to be able to get to sleep so that I could perform the next day, because as the lead scout of my sniper patrol and the combat first aider, you know, it was my role to be the eyes and the ears of my patrol. And my worst fear was not that I would step on an IED or cop a round to the chest. It would be that if I missed something, then the bloke behind me took the brunt of the explosion or copped a round to the chest. And that was something that I would have to live with for the rest of my life. So I had to find a tool that was going to allow me to get to sleep so I could get up in the morning and be at my best and be able to perform and do my job and be an asset to the team rather than a liability. Now, a point that I want to make here is that these tools are going to be different for every single person. What works for me might not necessarily work for you, and the tools that you use might not necessarily work for other people. So we need to add tools to our toolbox to be applied at the appropriate time that's going to elicit the response that we want. And look, man, it took me a little bit of time to figure this out because, you know, I went from this highly sympathetic stress response state in Afghanistan where your senses are on high alert all the time. And then, you know, you're back in your home environment and those senses are still up. So I had to find those tools and I had to tweak those tools to allow me to, you know, drive the relaxation state, the parasympathetic state, so that I could get back into society and function somewhat normally. For me, I love scuba diving. So when I'm underwater, I'm scuba diving. I'm literally focusing on my breath because that's what controls my buoyancy. So I'm in the moment and I'm thinking about where I'm at and nothing else matters. And the same thing goes for riding my motorbike in Thailand. I'll put a podcast on and I'll go for a cruise. And I literally am just focused on what I'm doing, where I'm at. I'm living in the moment and I'm not concerned about anything else. Now, for other people, breathing through a tube 30 meters underwater is going to drive the stress response, the sympathetic state. And likewise, riding a motorbike in Thailand might drive that sympathetic state again. So, you know, those tools are very important and how you use them is also important. So, you know, we need to look at adding these tools to our toolbox. We need to find the things that are going to allow us to relax, drive that parasympathetic state, allow us to dampen that signal from the sympathetic nervous system and basically tell our brain that, hey, everything's safe, we're cool, we can chill out, we can relax, and we can get back to our baseline, which is homeostasis. So the point that I'm trying to make here is that, you know, we need to have a toolbox full of different tools. So if you look at a builder, for example, you know, they have different tools for different jobs. And if you need to, you know, hammer a nail into the wall so you can hang a picture or something like that, then you're obviously going to use a specific tool. If you need to screw off a roof, then you're going to use a different tool. If you need to cut down a tree, you're going to use a different tool. If you need to put in some plumbing, drill a hole somewhere, you're going to use a different tool. If you need to blow some leaves off your driveway, that's a different tool as well. So the more tools that we have in our toolbox, the more options we have to be able to pick the right tool to get the job done that we're trying to achieve.
Yeah, I think that's a really good point. And I think also it's also a very good point to let people know that I think what happens when people have all these tools and they just try and use them all at once and they're like, why am I not good? I'm not using it. I don't know how to do this. I don't know how to do that. And all of a sudden they get overwhelmed. And so I think the way you just said it as like a toolbox is a great idea of how to say, you know, put the tools, you've got them, put them in a box. And then when you need one, pick it back out again, rather than just holding them all, thinking how and trying to juggle them all and not knowing how to use them. I think it's a great way of looking at it. And I think, yeah, and certainly from my experience and, you know, my experience in seeing other people, if people try to use too many at once or try to do too much of a deep dive into one initially, you know, just gradually get used to it, because it's a shock to the body to be able to take in this, to change your way of being or change your way of thinking or, you know, what's your social acceptance or social belief. To try and change that, so much of it instantly, it's a big shock to the body and the mind. So you've got to just gradually just chip away and chip away and chip away, and eventually it ingrains into you. So yeah, I agree. And I think also you said about you just going back to what you were talking about earlier when you said how being in like a fight or flight moment constantly and I mean it just reminded me of a story that happened to me. And after just coming back from when Sai got shot in the throat, that tour, I came back from it. And not long after, I'd gone out for a night out. I only had a couple of drinks, but my head wasn't right. I mean, I knew this moment wasn't right. Paranoia was there before I even had a drink. Anyway, I just to show you how severe my paranoia got, is I saw a guy coming out of a train station, an Asian bloke. And I thought he had a bomb in his bag. And no reason. It was just a guy coming back from work. And I genuinely believed there was a bomb in it. And I was telling myself in my head, no, he hasn't. And then it was, yes, he has. I just ran up, pushed everyone away, jumped on him, just shouted, he's got a bomb in his bag. And everyone, this is the middle of London, everyone, you know, ran away. And he was like, get off me. I was holding his hands out, thinking he's going to try and pull the trigger. And I was shouting, get the police, get the police. And the police came, you know, dealt with us both. And they realised he was just a guy, arrested me. Took me to the police station and said, look, do you think you've got PTSD? And I was like, no, of course not. So they charged me. And then the army, being the army, rather than trying to say, look, what's going on? What's wrong with you? You've just come back from tour. You know, you think that there's a bomb in someone's bag. Instead of that, they try kicking me out of the army. So it just added to everything. I couldn't believe it. It took, fortunately, like colonels and generals that knew me to, you know, that took it to court. When it went to court, they basically stepped in and said, no, this is wrong. So thankfully, it got brushed aside. But yeah.
Fuck, man, that is nuts. Now, how did you find out that you had PTSD? Like, was it an event that happened, or like, was it, you know, a slow burner where things started showing up in your life and you started noticing certain things? Like, talk to me about that.
You can trace it quite far back to the first tour I came back from. You know, like I say, it's just, there's a lot of killing going on in that one with Taliban. There were so many of them. Like I said, I had dozens and dozens of confirmed kills under my belt, and I had a young, fresh 20-year-old. I mean, I loved it at the time. I was just like, yeah, this is brilliant. This is what we were supposed to be doing. And when you're young and that age, there is nothing that can affect you. You know, you're kind of like your invincible kind of a persona.
And yeah, 100%, man. And dude, like, that's our job. We train as soldiers to go overseas and to deploy and fight whoever the enemy is. It is literally us versus them, and you are trained to fucking look after the boys either side of you and do whatever's necessary to keep them safe. So
exactly.
Now let's talk about what you mentioned earlier about your convoy being ambushed. Your vehicle was hit, the RPG didn't go off or it bounced off the armor. The vehicle behind you was hit, fucking exploded, killed everyone. Everyone else bugged out. You're sitting there. There's Taliban fighters running at you, trying to claim your scalp so they can show it off to all of their Taliban buddies to increase morale and, you know, claim the fucking death of an infidel, etc. And I'm assuming you're sitting there on a machine gun just fucking mowing dudes down as they're running towards you, trying to kill you.
Yeah, well, you'd like to think so. So just to paint the picture just a little bit more. So my vehicle, although the new armor came out, like a bar armor. So it's got, I don't know if you've seen it. It's got like the lions going across. It's made to capture RPGs. But till the first RPG came, and I just saw it coming from a distance, and I was like, holy fuck, that's gonna kill us. And then I think by the time I went, I put to get myself under to tell my commander, it exploded. So it didn't explode that, the actual vehicle, it hit the actual bar armor, and it exploded that. So it's still like, we were still like pretty much set on fire. And I think I must have passed out for a few seconds, and it came to him shaking me. And then another one went off on the left-hand side, another one went off on the front. So, you know, our vehicle was on fire everywhere, just being blown up. The driver's knocked out, completely unconscious. The vehicle's just rolled into a halt. Comms are gone dead. Over there, we can hear them saying, withdraw, withdraw. Everyone's dead. My commander's, we can see guys running. We're like, fuck, they're coming. So I threw a few grenades over. That dealt with the first wave. And then there was a guy on a Dushka that was firing out our vehicle. And it was like, you know, it's starting to penetrate the vehicle. So we're like, we need to take him out. Let's get a machine gun. Couldn't get a machine gun working. My commander's hitting me, saying, shoot him.
Like, mate, just pause there for a second, man, because I need to explain this to the listeners. A Dushka is a mounted fucking heavy weapon, 50 caliber machine gun that is used as an anti-aircraft weapon.
Yeah. I mean, it was every round.
And that thing causes some serious fucking damage.
Yeah, every round was just rocking us. You feel it coming through the air. And you're like, oh, so this isn't going well. It wasn't going well anyway, but this is going even worse. So my commander's like, get him. So I'm on my machine gun, it's not firing. I'm like, no. So what's going on? So anyway, I was like, I had no choice but to just get my rifle, get up on the thing, and then just find him. And I managed to get him with my rifle. So basically, and then I looked down, and my machine gun was split in half. So the explosion from the front RPG had completely annihilated it. So it was gone. So then I just had my rifle. My commander's down there trying to sort out comms. And it's just me on the top, and I literally can see tens, dozens of Taliban running towards me, and I've just got my rifle. And to make things worse, because of the explosion, dust has gone in it. So I had a cock each time I fired. So I'm just like, there's just rounds coming everywhere, and I'm just like, cock. But they were so easy to like take out because they were just running in the open. There was like, and then they were just firing, but they weren't very good. There's just rounds going everywhere, all around me, all over the vehicle. But there was none hitting me. And I think by this point, I'd already said, like, okay, I'm going to die. Let's just do what we can to take these out. And bear in mind, we've got our friends behind us, whose bodies you could see burning alive. So I'm fuming, thinking, well, they're dead. They've left us. Rounds everywhere. There's two of us. One of them is not, they know if my driver is dead or not. And I was just like, well, yeah, just do what we can. And eventually, the other lot got to the top of the hill, and just they then started seeing these guys coming forward, and they started attacking them, even though they didn't know he was alive. And then eventually my commander threw a smoke, I think it was like purple smoke, and then they were like, "Ah, oh, this smoke's been thrown." So they came down and got us and extracted us out. So yeah, that was that occasion. But I think coming back from that tour, going back to your question, when did I first realise I had PTSD? Looking back on it, I didn't realise at the time, but I had a girlfriend when I was only young. She was about 19, I was 20. And I think we'd gone out for a few drinks that night, and I come back and I woke up next morning and she was like in the corner of the room. I was like, "What are you doing?" She was like, "Can you just take me home?" I was like, "What are you talking about? What's going on?" And she was covered in bruises all up her arms. I was like, "What happened?" She was like, "You last night." I was like, "What?" And I literally never didn't remember. Apparently, I got up in the middle of the night, I was shaking her, grabbing her, throwing her around, and the poor girl was just like covered in bruises. So, look, and I think looking back now, I had about 8 weeks off, and I don't think there was a day that went past that 8 weeks where I wasn't going out drinking, you know. So I think I was waking up in the night with nightmares and like crying and stuff, but I didn't realise, or I just brushed it off, and I was like, "Oh, whatever, just forget about it, and just go out and have another drink." So I think that was the start of it, but I just didn't think about it. And, you know, the military didn't tell me this is what's going to happen to you. This is how you can make yourself better. This is the outcomes. It was just you go to tour, you come back, go and leave. They were like, go and get drunk, go and be stupid, spend all your money and then come back. And that's exactly what I did.
But, dude, you know, that is fucking heavy, man. And, you know, these things are happening, but you don't know why, because it's happening at a subconscious level that you have no control over, which is fucking scary, man. And, man, as soldiers, we need to compartmentalize things, because I'm assuming that within a week, you're back out on patrol again.
Literally, I think we flew from... So a helicopter came and got us. We went back to Bastion, but we hadn't been Bastion since the day we got there, because we were living out in the desert in our vehicles, and went back to Bastion, the patrol base, and the free para commando, Sergeant Major, came up to us and said, "Fucking good effort, boys. Well done. You did a good job out there today. Proud of you." And I was like, "Yeah, he's proud of me. Go on." And then there was a vehicle waiting, nice for us. Didn't have a chance to even get food, didn't get a shower, back in the vehicle, and off we went back to join our boys again. And yeah, that was it. So not even a day, not a week, an hour max until we had another vehicle and back out. My driver couldn't come back out. He was too traumatised. He was, you know, for what he'd seen, he was just stuck. He was just stuck at the driver. At least I had a gun. He was just stuck there, just watching all these bullets and everything go off in front of him. So yeah, he was in a bad way. So he mentally could not go out. But I was keen to get out, and I was like, "Yeah, let's go." But yeah, so there was no time to process anything.
Yeah, man, I'm going to come back to that in a moment, but I want to relate something you said there to my experience as well. So my four-man sniper team, 2 weeks into our trip, were ambushed, and my team leader was shot. We got in a firefight. We got control of the situation, patched him up, stabilized him, put him on a helicopter, sent him off, didn't know if he was going to live or die. And then the rest of our team, our three-man team, then found some high ground. So we went up there. So we could provide fire support, provide battlefield commentary, get eyes over the entire area, et cetera, et cetera. And within 30 minutes, one of the boys flicked some dirt aside, and he's like, he looked at us wide-eyed, and he goes, "Fuck, boys, we are sitting on top of a fucking IED. So anyway, that was a massive patrol. We got back to the base, man, and like within 30 minutes of rebombing and going through my battle prep, I was fucked. I was like in bed sleeping, man, because I was so fucking tired because of the massive adrenaline dump. So the next day we went out on patrol, burst machine gun fire, went between my mate and I was like, "Fuck, man, this is going to be a long trip." But, you know, what that made me do was made me realize that they were there to fucking hurt us. And, you know, that changed our mindset of, right, like, we need to take the fight to these guys. We need to fucking deny them freedom of movement. We now need to kill or capture as many of them as we can so that we can make our fucking deployment and the lives of the local population a lot safer.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think that point you just touched on, you know, you have to be in that sort of mindset to do the sort of stuff that you're being asked to do, and you have to do to save your life and everyone else's lives around you, as well as protect the people's lives you're out there to protect. You have to have that fighting mindset, and there's nothing wrong with that. And I think a lot of people get confused with mental health or mindset or meditation with being pink and fluffy, and you know, if you do that, you're going to get rid of you're not going to have these killer guys that you need on the battlefield. It's completely not true. You know, I mean, pretty much everyone in the special forces uses these techniques because, and they have done for many years, because they know that, you know, that the stuff that they're going to go and see, that the environments they're going to be in, the mental state they're going to be, they need something to you know, make themselves to get better again. And I think times are changing. People are starting to see that it's not about being soft and pink and fluffy. It's about being sensible. It's about training your mind just as much as you train your body. It's about strengthening your mind. That's as much as I think. You know, we focus every day on how we can physically look after ourselves in the military, but you know, mentally it's just as important, if not more so. It's a much more fragile, a much more stronger tool or part of our body than our actual physical body.
Oh, 100%, mate. And going back to that story I was speaking about earlier with my sniper team and the first 2 weeks now, you know, I was using my breath work to help me to get to sleep. But, you know, the byproduct of that was I was actually able to manage my emotions a lot better, which obviously drove the parasympathetic nervous system and allowed me to get to sleep. But I didn't realize it at the time because, you know, we would head into our CP for orders and the boss is like, all right, boys, we're going here tomorrow. This is the plan. You know, let me know what each one of you guys are going to do, where you're going to set up, you know, what your role is, how you're going to support the mission, et cetera, et cetera. And there were certain times where boss was like, yeah, we're going in this location. We all fucking looked at each other and like, all right, well, we know we're going to be in the shit tomorrow. So, you know, that means that I'm going back to my boys and I'm saying, hey, lads, we're going here. You need to be carrying this, you know, maybe carry an extra fucking first aid kit, some saline fluid, stock up on extra high explosive grenades, blah, 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 blah. You know, we're choosing the weapon systems that is going to best suit that situation, knowing that every fucking time we go to that location, we're in the shit. Something's happening. We're finding caches. We're capturing dudes. We're killing dudes. We're fucking getting in firefights. You know, we're taking casualties, et cetera, et cetera. So, you know, that meditation, that mindfulness that I was doing by simply focusing on my breath, like actually helped me strengthen my mind and focus on the things that I could control rather than the things that I couldn't control. And man, that was massive for me. And it's something I've implemented in my life ever since. Now, another thing that I want to talk about here is those tools need to be appropriate. So last year, around about this time, I went back to Australia to do my yoga course. One of the boys got out of the army and was suffering from PTSD, actually used yin-style yoga as an alternate therapy for PTSD, anxiety, and depression. So he ended up becoming a teacher and got a partial grant from the Australian government to teach a bunch of veterans so that we could take it back to our network and share with our guys to give them the tools that they needed. And, you know, something that came up for us that we had a really good discussion about was, you know, these are all infantry soldiers that have been in Afghanistan, taking the fight to the enemy. And we're all sitting there going, you know, how many of our mates that are suffering are going to be comfortable sitting in a fucking room full of random people for an hour in silence? Like, that's not going to be appropriate for them. They're in this fucking highly sympathetic state all the time. That's going to freak them out. So, you know, we need to take those principles of, hey, what are we doing here? We're using this tool to downregulate the sympathetic nervous system, drive the parasympathetic nervous system, you know. So for that person, that tool needs to be tailored to provide the right dose to get the right response. And that might simply be 5 minutes of guided meditation every day whilst they're, you know, watching the sunrise and having a coffee or something like that. And once you can do that for a month, then go 10 minutes of guided meditation every day. And then you might bump that up to 20 minutes guided meditation every day. There's 3 months. And then, all right, cool. The next progression is unguided meditation, I don't even want you to focus on time. I just want you to focus on giving me 20 breaths. Boom. And that takes me around about 5 minutes every morning. So, you know, the dose response relationship comes into play here. And yes, we need to work with these principles, but we also need to adjust them so that we can apply the right amount to the people to elicit the response that we want and meet the person where they're at.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think, I was just going to say, I think it's a great way of looking at things, you know, just building up. And just, I think another thing is just being aware of tools that are out there, you know, and methods that are out there. You know, like I think I said it earlier, you don't have to know everything at once. You just have to be aware. And for me, I'm a big believer in just planting a seed. So if rather than saying no back to something, if someone says to me, what about this? Rather than saying no, I just go, okay, what is it? And then in my head, I'm going, well, no, that's not for me really. But then I just leave it there. I don't dismiss it. I don't throw it away completely. I just leave it. And then maybe like a few weeks or a few months later, something happens. And I think, oh, do you remember? How about that? And then all of a sudden it starts to grow. And then all of a sudden, a few more months down the line, I'm doing it fully. And I'm fully, you know, into whatever the situation may be. So I'm a big believer of just planting the seed. You don't have to say yes or no instantly. Just be aware of something and then see, just let it naturally come to you. Naturally, it will find its way to you if it's meant to be.
Yeah, man, that is such a good point. Because if we go into something and we've already created that story that this is not going to work, this is bullshit, blah, 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 then we're fucking right. Because like the placebo effect has been shown multiple times, so often, how much of an impact that it can have on, you know, changing mindsets, changing health, changing, you know, results of studies. It's fucking crazy, man, the power of the mind. So, you know, we need to be open to these things. And as you said, you need to put the ego aside. And because if you don't do that, then there's going to be lessons that are available to you that you're not ready to listen to. You know, we could read the same book and we can both take different lessons from it, but you know, we read that book and then a year later we read that same book again, we're going to be taking different lessons because we're at a different consciousness level. We're at a different level of awareness. We're looking for different things. We read that book again 5 years later and we're going to be taking different lessons again from that. So yeah, that's a great point, man. Now, what I want to talk about next is your transition period. Like, talk to me about that process going from being in the military for such a long period of time and then all of a sudden being back on Civvy Street. What was that like for you?
For me, it's been a very weird, it's not been a normal transition. So you know, I got put on sick leave and where, like I said earlier, they left me in barracks on sick leave and I was like, you know, this is not good for me. I'm not, you know, I wasn't getting any better because I was still in that environment, and I was fully aware that the trigger was the military. It was the environment. I knew that's what I needed to escape. So I kind of put myself into the civilian environment before I got forced into it. And then from there, you know, I didn't have the pressure of having to find work or anything like that. I was still getting paid by the military, so in a way, I was quite fortunate. But I had to work on myself. I think the biggest thing for me was I felt, even though I genuinely had issues, I knew I did, but I think I still felt like a fraud. I still felt like, you know, why am I? You know, I think we have that this kind of comparison complex of people. I shouldn't feel like this when I've got a friend who's like this, or there's someone else who's even worse, or this person's even worse. And we try to compare ourselves all the time rather than just accepting that, you know, we're allowed to have problems for every reason. So yeah, and since being, you know, I haven't gone back into work either. I've got some savings and I'm just fully committed to this charity now. You know, there is no plan B. There is no safety net for me. I'm like, I've taken myself out of work. I don't even care about finding work because I know that the purpose of this charity is the most important thing. And there's nothing that can stop me or us, or everyone that's involved in it from achieving the £3 million and getting the retreat built. If we just keep on working at it, my mind's fully open that if you just consistently work hard on something, you will achieve whatever you want. And this is exactly what we're doing. So for me, if I went back to work in Civilian Street, my mind won't be focused on this charity. It'll be half focused on the work whilst thinking about the charity. And then every now and then I'll be able to dip in and out. So yeah, so the transitions, it'll be a bit unfair for me to comment because I know most people have to go from military straight into civilian life, where I kind of had a little bit of a leeway to sort myself out. So yeah, it's been a bit different one for me.
Let's talk about that for a moment, because you mentioned earlier that there was certain triggers in your environment, and you know, being back in that military space was setting things off. And I'm a firm believer in you becoming a product of your environment. However, you need to create the right environment so that you can be your best person. Now, was there times where you went into therapy and, you know, you were being painted with a victim brush that you potentially bought into, or, you know, started acting in accordance with? Was there anything like that that was happening to you?
Yeah. I don't know. I completely understand where you're coming from and what you're saying. Possibly. But I think, like, for example, there's a lot of things subconsciously that I still don't understand what was happening. For example, I'd be in a meeting with, you know, with a hierarchy, and I could see people's mouths moving, but I couldn't hear any words coming out. Like, I physically couldn't, I could not hear any word coming out of someone's mouth, but I'd be able to hear a chair scraping or something. So that's something I don't even understand. And I tried to get answers from psychiatrists, and they couldn't give them to me. So I don't know. But, you know, again, subconsciously, maybe I was creating some sort of victim thing. And certainly, you know, like I was staying in bed most of the day. If I had to go to work, I'd go there and then, you know, I'd look at a computer screen and like this overwhelming like flood of anxiety came over me, and I just literally ran back to bed again. I was like, oh, I've got to stay here. I can't be in that environment. So I certainly was becoming more of a victim to myself. You know, I was a sergeant major walking down through the parade square, getting all anxious about seeing a trooper. You know, it should be the other way around. So, but yeah, I certainly think that you can create that victim mindset. But it's very hard to get out of it when if you're not aware of it, or even if you are aware of it, if you don't know what's going on, if you there's no one to explain to you what's happening or why it's happening or how you can make it any better, it's a very difficult thing to try and come out of.
Yeah, dude, that is so interesting, man. And again, that goes back to that environment, because you know you're in this room where people are talking, you can see their mouth moving, but you can't hear them. Yet a chair scrapes and your attention is focused on that chair. And that is because you don't perceive the person that is talking to be a threat. So you're not paying attention to it. As soon as something happens that you're not prepared for, or that is out of the ordinary, then that's where your attention goes and you're still in that heightened sympathetic state. So yeah, man, your environment plays a massive part there. Now, something I want to talk about here is, when you realized that and then you went on holidays with Si and you found a shack in, you know, the mountains of Scotland, and you started running and you started looking after your nutrition, you started sleeping better, you started doing your journaling, your affirmations and all that type of stuff, like how much of an impact did that have for you, if any?
Yeah, massively. Huge therapeutic effect. And almost like instantly, you know, and you know, coming out of that environment, it just, every day, you know, I think, the best way to describe it, on the weekends when I wasn't in the military, I was able to escape. I was like a new person, like a new ball person. I looked forward to it. Come the Sunday, knowing that I had to go back, everything just going back downhill because I knew what was coming. But yeah, as soon as I was able to go away, go to Scotland, start learning the affirmation, stop not learning, but start practicing like affirmation, start practicing just being in nature. You know, we were in the Highlands in Scotland, and I don't know if some of your listeners know about the Highlands of Scotland, but it's just mountain after mountain. It's just picturesque. It's unbelievable. And we were so lucky to be there during lockdown for 10 weeks. And with one of my best mates as well, you know, we just go by the river. And not only was we in the mountains, no one was there because everyone was locked down. So we had the whole mountains and all the rivers to ourselves. So we'd literally go for a run up a hill, or take a couple of cans and sit by a nice, cool river, just me and Si, no one else around us to disturb us. It was absolutely amazing. And it certainly helped, I'm sure, both of us with any problems that we might have been having. But then I'll, and to just to clarify with the environment, Once I'd got myself to a really good place, and I was practicing all this stuff, and you know, not saying that every day was perfect, because not every day is ever going to be perfect for anyone. But I was in such a much better place. I was able to come up with a charity, come up with sort of feeling like I'm going to do a 5,800-mile run, and I was starting to plan it and get everything in place. I was getting media attention and doing all sorts of stuff. And then for the last couple of months, I got rid of the house I was staying in, sold my car, get ready to go on my run. And then that's when the second lockdown came in, so I couldn't do it. So I had nowhere to live. So I said to my regiment, can I come and stay back at the regiment for the last couple of months? They were like, yeah, of course. And I went and stayed there. And almost instantly, my behaviour changed. My attitude started going down. But then I started going, no, I'm better than this, because I've got all these tools and techniques. And I started trying to use all these tools and techniques. And I was like, and it was really scary, because I was like, I was just dipping and dipping and dipping. And I was like, crap. And then all of a sudden, I found myself staying in bed for like 3-4 days, and I was getting back to that routine I was in before. I didn't want to see people like walking up and down the corridors. I was getting all like anxious, and I was like, oh no, this is not good. I'm like, no matter how much I tried to like fight it or use the techniques, for me in that environment, I just couldn't do it. So again, I just had to go like to get out, and I'm staying with someone else at the moment. But for me, I know I'm not saying that I can't ever get better in an environment, but maybe it was just a bit too soon. But yeah, so environment's a very strange one. And maybe it's something I need, if I want to go back to that environment, I need to start working a bit more on realizing how I can do that.
Yeah, that's an excellent point, mate. Your environment plays a massive part in who you are, and, you know, creates changes with your physiology, and, you know, your emotions and your thoughts affect your hormone regulation, which then affect how you're feeling, your mood, your attitude, and, you know, your actions, and, you know, everything is fucking interrelated, man. So, you know, you use these tools when you're in a good environment, and that worked an absolute treat for you. However, going back to that environment where those triggers were, you know, you didn't have the tools to be able to utilize at that time. So that's an excellent point that I want to touch on here, is that if you are someone that is struggling with, you know, mental health implications, and you've used these tools and you find yourself getting better, but then you get back into that environment and you fall back into that downward spiral, then, you know, you've probably gone back into that environment too fast, and you need to remove yourself from that environment so that you can create the changes that you want, so that when you do go back onto base, you know, maybe you only spend an hour there the first time and you feel like shit, and you go, all right, I need to get the fuck out of here, right? And then the next time you go back, it might be 2 hours, and then you increase that to 4 hours, and then you increase that to the whole day, and then maybe you can stay overnight, right? So you're using progressive overload with these tools and gradually reintroducing the environment that is creating this negative spiral, so that you can progressively over time be able to deal with that better and better each time.
Yeah, I think that's a great point. Absolutely great point. And again, it just comes from experience sometimes, experience and being aware of it, you know. Like, so now we're talking about it and we're fully aware. And there'll be many people out there not aware whatsoever that of their feelings, not aware of their emotions, or aware of why they're feeling this way. And they'll just keep, like you say, digging a hole and digging a hole. So it's just so important that people take time out of their day, every day if they can, to learn different tools and techniques. Even if initially you don't think it's going to benefit you, just look at it. Just see what it's about, and then you can put it aside for a little while and then go look at something else. Because just being aware of listening to podcasts, like what we're doing now, listening to other people talking, to other people's experiences. That was one of my big things that helped me, was listening to different podcasts, listening to motivational talks. When I decided to change my life around, I just get up every single morning. The first thing I put on was a motivational talk on YouTube. You know, it's like one of the like a discipline or wake up kind of motivational talk, and it would just get me in that mood. And I'll go to the gym and I'll go for a walk.
Something really powerful that you just said there was, when I decided to change my life, that right there in my mind is the fucking key, man, because, you know, you need to, if you want to make changes, you need to create changes. And sometimes that means changing your environment. That means paying attention to, you know, who you let into your inner circle. This means paying attention to everything that you're doing in regards to nutrition, training, you know, social media use, et cetera, et cetera. So, you know, when you decided to make that decision to change your life, like that, you took ownership of that. That is you being accountable for your own shit and understanding that, yes, there's some things that you've done to put yourself in this situation, but there's also things that you can do to get yourself out of that situation. And again, that's where those tools come into play, where you can start like picking and choosing the right tools. And you need to have as many tools in your toolbox as you can so that when something does come up, you can go, all right, this is the right tool for this time that's going to allow me to, you know, stop digging that hole and then start fucking climbing my way out of the hole. And as I said about, you know, your environment, like this is your home as well, man. Like you need to fucking feel safe in your home, because if you don't feel safe in your home and you're still in this upregulated sympathetic nervous system, you're going to be paying attention to all of the noises that are going on, you know, everything that's happening in that environment, which could potentially still be upregulating that sympathetic nervous system. So finding a place where you feel safe, where you can downregulate, fire up the parasympathetic nervous system, relax, get some quality sleep, you know, that is fucking critical.
And I think another point with the environment is not just the environment as a place or like a building or, you know, but it's also the people. Like for when I decided to make a big change, I decided, look, you know, a friend of mine had just hung himself outside my door. I was literally going to be the next number. I just knew it. I was waiting for the day where I was going to do it. And then I said, no, okay, this is going to change. This changes now. Or it's either now or never. And, you know, and I excluded pretty much everyone out of my life. I know it sounds a bit harsh, but I thought, do you know what? And it's not because of other people, it's because of how I associated myself with people. So for Sire, for example, great mate, great guy, you know, you'd be lucky to go out and have a drink with him because he's good company. But I didn't see him for about 8 months. I said to him, like, I can't see you. I'm sorry, like a whole group of guys, like, you know, you're not in my life for now while I'm working on myself. So whilst I was working on myself, I excluded that group of friends and others. And I actually started to find different people to hang around with. Different people that I associated myself in a more positive way, and then once I was better again, or once I felt better, you know, I started introducing Sy back into my life. I was like, "Hey, mate, can you fancy going out?" And he's like, "Yeah, sure." And you know, we became friends again. And it wasn't, and you know, he's such a good bloke that he didn't ever question me. He didn't say, you know, "Why did you want to hang around with me for them few months?" He just knew. He knew I was working on myself, and he was there waiting to pick up the phone as soon as I was ready to call him up and go for a drink again. And I think that's important, is to, you know, think about not just the environment of the place you are, but the people you're with. And it doesn't have to be because they're bad people. It's because how you associate yourself with them at that moment in time. And you can always come back and reintroduce them back into your life later.
Another very good point that I'll dive into in a little bit more detail as well. You know, you decided to make these changes, which meant that you needed to change your environment, which meant that some of the people that were in that environment need to change as well, and you need to disassociate from them. Now, here's the thing, man. Like, when you go through something big like this, when you need to work on yourself and you put it out there to your friends and say, hey, look, guys, I need to take this time away from myself. I can't see you for a while, blah, 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 blah. You'll be able to tell who your real fucking friends are, because they're going to be the ones that are like, totally understand, you do whatever you need to do, mate. My phone's always on. Give me a call anytime something comes up. You know, when you've worked on yourself, when you're feeling better, when you're comfortable to be back around the boys again and you know, want to pick this back up again, you know, we can help each other. Then let's fucking do that. Let's pick right back up where we left off. Although both of us are going to be in a better place, and we're going to cultivate that friendship, we're going to cultivate that relationship. And then there's going to be other people that are like, oh, why are you cutting me out of your life? You're an asshole, blah, blah, blah. Like, those people are fucking feeding their own ego, and, you know, they obviously don't understand that for you to be at your best, that means that, you know, you need to make sacrifices. And sometimes those friendships are going to be those sacrifices. So, you know, having good people around you that understand that and support that is critical, man. That is extremely important for your own personal and you know, your own personal growth and development. And, you know, it makes it very clear to who actually cares about you and who doesn't care about you.
Yeah, absolutely. And do you want to be that same person? Is that the whole point? Is you're trying to change So if they don't want you to change from the person that you're, the struggling person, then they're not a friend. That's not, if they can't see you, if they don't see the struggles inside of you, or that they're the potential struggle inside of you, then they don't know you as well as you probably think that they do.
Mate, this has been an incredible conversation, man. I've really enjoyed this one. It's been great to connect with you, to find out what's happening with Head Up Charity, what you're doing there, what your vision is, everything you're working towards. And I think this conversation is going to help a lot of people, man. So, brother, I want to thank you very much for your time. I'll be following your journey quite closely. I want to get you back on the podcast at some stage, maybe right before you kick off your run, or at some stage during, maybe even after. But yeah, I'll definitely be following your story and passing it off to my audience. So just to wind up, mate, I want to say thank you very much for sharing your time, your journey, your emotions, everything you've been through, man. I really appreciate you opening up and having this conversation with me, bro.
Yeah, thank you so much. It's been great to learn more about yourself, and it's always good to talk and to open up to different platforms, different people around the world, which is an amazing thing to do. Look forward to working with Swiss 8 hopefully in the future, and you know, I think it'd be what a fantastic thing would it be for two different countries from opposite sides of the world, you know, helping each other's veterans and military people out. I think it could be a great partnership. So really looking forward to get that going. And if anyone wants to follow the journey, just simply type in Head Up Charity to any of the social media platforms, and you should be able to find us.
Awesome, mate. I'm going to have all of those links in the show notes. Thank you very much, brother. We shall chat soon.
Yeah, brilliant. Thanks a lot.